Well, it's now my great pleasure to introduce Tim Nepper from Drake University in the United States. And, well, we're extremely grateful to have Tim with us. He's gone to extreme efforts to be with us. Some of you will have known about the little mishaps that have occurred along the way. But just before this this conference, Tim was at an interfaith sort of meeting gathering in Denver, Colorado, something
like that.
In Aspen. And that is sort of symptomatic of the kind of work that Tim's been doing over recent years with what's called the Comparison Project at Drake University, which has had a very impressive series of seminars and various kinds of events and sort of outreach programs, bringing in people from different religious communities within Des Moines is the town in Iowa, and facilitating not only interfaith dialogue but the sort of communication of different religious perspectives. Within the more sort of specifically academic sphere, Tim has published extensively in the area of the idea of ineffability, which came through a little bit in some of Tim's comments in discussion yesterday. And Tim's book, The Ends of Philosophy of Religion, Terminus and Telos, which I mentioned briefly in my introductory remarks yesterday morning, is a very innovative work proposing various ways in which philosophy of religion might be developed in indeed cross-cultural and multi-religious ways, as the theme of this conference has it. And today, Tim's going to be talking to us on philosophy of religion as journey, using the journey metaphor to restructure the philosophy of religion. So please join me in welcoming Tim Nepper.
Thanks. Day three, wearing the same clothes.
No clothes.
But the bag has been found.
And we'll arrive in Manchester at 3:30, just in time for me to head back.
Ever get on a train in the morning heading to a conference and realize that you wrote the wrong presentation? Because I finally read the title that I gave you, and that's not the talk I prepared. But I think the talk that I prepared is more engaging for you all, and you have more critical things to say about it. I did, though, given my commitments to Mick, I wanted to briefly mention, discuss what we've been doing with the Comparison Project. At Drake, it started as a lecture and dialogue series in comparative philosophy of religion, where we take scholar lectures and practitioner dialogues on a theme for 2 years, and then have philosophers of religion come and compare over and philosophize about those themes and comparative perspective. We're halfway through right now a series on miracles. Before that, we had done death and dying with a focus on the medicalization of death and how it affects traditional understandings and practices. And before that, ineffability. The ineffability book is out now. 13 or so essays and 2 comparative conclusions, some involving art, music, poetry, and so forth, so it's cast pretty widely. We have a book series publishing contract with Springer, through whom he publishes. So, opportunities for you to come to Drake and give lectures. I don't know what our next theme will be, maybe religious violence, but we're always looking for specialists who can talk about the topic from the perspective of some particular religious tradition or thinker or text. And we've been able to get $1,000 honorarium for the lectures, so I'm monitoring something as well. Recently, we've been working a lot with the religions in Des Moines, of which there's an incredible diversity because of all the refugees and immigrants. And just in terms of Bosnian mosques, we have 3 and 10 mosques total. So you wouldn't expect that of a city of about 100,000. But we've done a lot of work, including our students and communities. We have a student written a photo narrative about religion in Des Moines that's raised $25,000 for a food pantry network. We do an open house series of interfaith youth camps, and we're working on maybe taking it to Beijing, and also implementing the interfaith youth camps through the campfire program. Now, for the actual talk. My talk has 2 main objectives. First, to propose a new set of fundamental categories for global or cross-cultural or comparative philosophy of religion. Second, to illustrate how these categories can be used to carry out such a philosophy of religion. This talk, therefore, attempts to distill my current efforts to write an undergraduate textbook in global critical philosophy of religion, which is a product of the five-year American Academy of Religion seminar in global critical philosophy of religion. So my talk begins by taking two quick steps backwards. Our seminar was approved in 2015 with the understanding that we would produce an undergraduate textbook in global critical philosophy of religion, as well as several volumes of critical essays. Why an undergraduate textbook in global critical philosophy of religion? With few, perhaps no exceptions, there simply are no undergraduate textbooks that are both inclusive of the religious philosophies of the world and engage in critical issues in the method and theory of religious studies. Many of us therefore felt that no matter how many specialist essays and monographs were published in the field, we would not affect real change in the field until we began producing undergraduate textbooks to compete with those of traditional theistic philosophy of religion. The seminar is now entering its fourth year, although our first year's meeting in 2015 brimmed with enthusiasm and produced no tangible results. Our objective had been that of itemizing the fundamental topics of the many different religious philosophies of the globe with the hopes of rising, so to speak, to a core hybridized set of topics for global philosophy of religion. Perhaps this method was ill-conceived from the get-go. Regardless, the papers and presentations were so spotty, with the exception of Jacob Sherman's, Rich, which was read in the seminar.
That's right.
Brilliant, brilliant paper. The papers and presentations were so spotty that we never even assembled a collective list of topics, let alone weed them down to a core list. At the second year's meeting in 2016, we therefore decided to begin afresh and think about the learning objectives of the textbook in hopes of doing so would help us think more clearly about how to arrange its content. Perhaps it did, perhaps it didn't. Regardless, the co-chairs of the seminar, Gary Kopf and I, presented our respective sets of learning objectives alongside our proposals for the structure of the book. Gary's is a multi-entry book organized by contemporary philosophies of religion, each written by a living philosopher of religion, who would also respond to the other philosophies of religion. Mine is using the journey metaphor to generate a new set of fundamental topics for global critical philosophy of religion. Out of no other reasons than desperation and diplomacy, the seminar ultimately thought we should write both books. Gehring's as a kind of teaching manual or even a textbook in itself, mine as a textbook to be accompanied by an anthology of primary sources. In year three, these textbook projects and the AAR seminar meetings began to diverge from one another. The core members of the seminar met for a workshop at Drake University to sketch the content of both textbooks. Kevin was part of that. Whereas the AAR meeting invited papers on one of two content sections of my textbook, Philosophies of the Self or Philosophies of the Cosmos. Oh, Philosophies of the Self is actually what we did. Our meeting this coming November has invited papers on the other content section of my textbook, Philosophies of the Cosmos. With any luck, our fifth and final meeting in 2020 will then review a draft of my entire textbook, if not Gary's too. Meanwhile, we will soon edit the essays for the first of three volumes of critical essays, which contains sections on global inclusiveness and critical engagement. Then we will issue calls for two more essay collections, one on philosophy of the self and one on philosophies of the cosmos. Finally, we hope to apply for an NEH summer seminar or simply to schedule another workshop for the summer of 2020. And there is room in these collections. I'm going to get to the business of editing papers for the global critical collection in the fall, but there's still time to submit things if you're interested, and we'll give you the call. And then in subsequent years, we'll be doing calls for the other two volumes. Okay. For the rest of my talk, I will focus exclusively on my own textbook, first explaining how I use the journey metaphor to restructure the fundamental topics of global critical philosophy of religion, then showing how these topics can be used to philosophize about the self and cosmos in global breadth, and finally reviewing the methodological chapters of my textbook to better understand what makes this philosophy of religion critical as well. Why use the journey metaphor to restructure the philosophy of religion? I suppose the preliminary question is why restructure the philosophy of religion at all? For me, the answer to this question is obvious. The topics of traditional philosophy of religion are thoroughly unsuitable to the inclusion of most of the religious philosophies of South Asia, East Asia, Africa, Australia, and the Americas. Take, for example, the three teachings of China, Confucianism, Taoism, and Buddhism. Questions about the attributes of God, proofs of the existence of God, and the problem of evil for an omnipredicated God have no relevance to any of these teachings. For any philosophy of religion that attempts merely to extend the reach of traditional topics to these teachings, and there are lots of textbooks that do this, then these teachings simply appear wrong, inferior, or weird. And so I argue that if the philosophy of religion is to be globally relevant, it must be rethought from the ground up, not merely enlarged or expanded. How does one do this rethinking? One way involves simply employing the chief issues and themes from some other religious philosophy. For example, how to live in harmony with the natural, social, and spiritual worlds, how to organize states that are conducive to flourishing and balance, especially in relationship to heaven or nature, Tian, how to actualize and return to states of non-differentiated unity. Topics from Chinese religious philosophy. Although this has the desired effect, at least in my mind, of making traditional theistic philosophy of religion look inferior or weird, it doesn't help much in restructuring the topics of philosophy of religion to make it global or cross-cultural or comparative. Another way to rethink the fundamental topics of global critical philosophy of religion involves the method that we tried to employ during our first meeting at the AAR seminar, to make a list of all the issues and topics of all the different religious philosophies and see where there is significant overlap. Where I think the book arrangement method is one we could try as well. In case there is concern that this procedure smacks of perennial philosophy, let me say that I don't find such concern warranted, for we are looking only for an overlap of questions that are asked, not an overlap of answers that are provided. Still, I have two other concerns about this procedure. First, it's laborious in its process. Second, it places an undue burden on its results, requiring every single religious philosophy to share a core group of answerable questions with every other religious philosophy. Surely there will be some religious philosophy that enters a null result with regard to some question that is answered by many of the other religious philosophies. A third way to rethink the fundamental topics of global critical philosophy of religion is simply to propose a set of topics and test them against the religious philosophy of the world, something I'm thinking of as abductive. But which set of topics? I've wondered at times about the viability of looking to the three main branches of Western philosophy for such topics, metaphysics, epistemology, and axiology. But given my experience with and fondness for Lakoff and Johnson's metaphor theory, I opted instead to begin with the journey metaphor. In fact, it was at the last meeting of the International Association for the History of Religions that, while sitting in a session on metaphor theory, I began sketching how the constituent parts of the journey metaphor might be used to develop fundamental topics and questions for global critical philosophy of religion. Who am I as a traveler? Where do I come from? Where am I going? How do I get there? And so forth. You ever do your best thinking, you know, at conferences and someone else is speaking and they get ideas, start coming, they write it down? It happens to me all the time. So there's a strong sense in which my efforts to employ the journey metaphor to restructure philosophy of religion are simply the product of my own intellectual biography. Less biographically, however, I offer three arguments for the viability of using the journey metaphor to restructure the philosophy of religion. First, journeys actually do serve to metaphorically structure religious growth and maturation in many different religious traditions. Second, if Lakoff and Johnson are correct, then the journey metaphor implies primary metaphors that are both fundamental to cognition and widespread, if not universal, in manifestation. Third, as I will attempt to show in the next two sections, the journey metaphor actually works to restructure the philosophy of religion. So, the pragmatist to be, try it out and see if it works. Before getting to this demonstration, though, I need to spend a little more time with the structure of the journey metaphor. By journey metaphor, I mean more exactly the metaphor life as a journey, which utilizes the conceptual structure of a journey to understand and express the temporal dimension of people's lives. According to Lakoff and Johnson, life as a journey is a complex or molecular metaphor composed of the cultural belief that everyone is supposed to have a purpose in life. The primary metaphor is purposes or destinations, and actions or motions, and the fact that a long trip to a series of destinations is a journey. This complex metaphor also encompasses four sub-metaphors. A purposeful life is a journey, a person living a life as a traveler, life goals or destinations, and a life plan as an itinerary. Finally, the journey metaphor has several entailments or conceptual implications, among which are that one should plan the route, anticipate obstacles, be prepared, and have an itinerary. What is most important for my own purposes are the core constituent parts of the journey metaphor, which are as follows. Journeys have a point of origin and a destination, a route that is planned, obstacles and sights that are encountered along the way, and a traveler who is accompanied by and encounters other travelers. Although these constituent parts are not themselves philosophical questions or topics, they can be used to generate such questions or topics, five of which are most significant for our purposes. Who am I, if anything? Where do I come from, if anywhere? Where am I going, if anywhere? How do I get there, if by any means? And what obstacles, if any, lie in my way? Several quick comments are in order about these questions. First, each question is purposefully vague, requiring specification by means of the precise content of some religious philosophy. For example, the I might be understood as an individual, a people, human beings in general, or nothing at all. Second, these philosophical questions can be answered for a religious philosophy even if it doesn't think of individual lives as purposeful or draw on the metaphor life as a journey. For example, the questions, where am I going and how do I get there, might have a meaningful answers, even if the religious philosophy does not explicitly conceptualize human beings as having destinations and paths. Third, it is not the case that a religious philosophy has to have a positive or explicit answer to the five questions above to have a significant answer to them. For example, a religious philosophy might hold that thinking there is a self that travels some path to some destination is precisely what needs to be overcome. Finally, although the five questions above are questions that have been neglected by traditional philosophy religion, there are also questions that neglect the topics of traditional philosophy religion. Entirely missing in these five questions are the core problems of traditional theistic philosophy religion: attributes of God, existence of God, problem of evil. My solution to this, I believe, is simple and elegant. I begin by recognizing that in some philosophies of religion, the cosmos can be thought of being on a journey of sorts, at least in the sense of having an origin, destination, path, and obstacles. I then note that in some philosophies of religion, the crucial relationship is that between humans as microcosm and cosmos as macrocosm. Finally, I show how reduplicating the five questions above with regard to the cosmos yield a second set of rich questions for philosophy of religion. What is the cosmos, if anything? Where does the cosmos come from, if anywhere? Where is the cosmos going, if anywhere? How does the cosmos get there, if by any means? And what obstacles, if any, lie in the cosmos's way? Again, I hasten to add the qualifications above also apply to the set of questions. These questions are vague and need to be made precise by concrete religious philosophies. Religious philosophies can meaningfully answer or reject these questions without assuming that the cosmos is teleological. I've gotten some pushback on that, so I welcome your criticisms. Thus, rejections of these questions are as important and significant as answers to these questions. With these qualifications in place, I'm rather confident that these five questions, along with the first set of five questions, offer a radically new point of departure for philosophy and religion, one that can be inclusive of the religious philosophies of the globe in a manner that does not unduly privilege any one religious philosophy. Now it is a matter of showing how. In the next two sections of my talk, I will show how each of these questions generates topics for philosophy of religion and embraces content from a global diversity of religious philosophies. For the sake of space in the textbook, I consider only six traditions of philosophy of religion around the globe through time, which I shorthand here as follows: East Asian, South Asian, West Asian or Abrahamic, African, and I focus on Yoruba, Native American, I focus on Lakota, and contemporary. In doing so, I will unfortunately engage in a fair amount of generalization, particularly in this talk, but this is only for the sake of economy. In reality, I advocate looking at individual thinkers, individual texts, and debates rather than generalizing over traditions, avoiding isms as much as possible. The first question about the self is simply, what is it? It's important here to note that by self, I don't mean a Cartesian self, even though that, of course, is one view of the self. Perhaps to be more accurate, we could put the question in terms of a journeyer rather than a self. Who or what is journeying? The first question leads us into territory about the journeyer's external relationships and internal processes, whether the self is an individual and whether the self is substantial. I focus the South Asian section, perhaps predictably, on the early disagreement between the Upanishadic and Buddhist sages about the existence of an eternal, unchanging Atman or Purusha. From there, I move to the Lakota saying, all my relations, which concludes every Lakota ritual, underscoring an interdependency both between humans and other species, both animate and inanimate. The Yoruba section looks at the component parts of the self, the physical body, Ara, the principle of life, Emi, and the head, Ori, the last of which is the bearer of the destiny and personality of the self. The East Asian material examines the Confucian self through the five great relationships and the Tao self through the Taoist spontaneity. The Abrahamic section begins by looking at the variety of terms for soul and spirit and ends by examining the notions of Fana and Baka and Sufism. Finally, I end by taking up both limited materialism's reduction of the self to material states and post-Marxism's dispersion of the self into ideological processes. In the end, then, our question about what the self is leads us into critical territory about whether the self is. My second question about the self concerns its origins. Where does it come from? Here I tackle questions about how the self understands itself given its origin. So the question is really this: how does my origin determine or affect what it is that I am as a member of the human species in general or some people in particular? Or to put it succinctly, why am I the way I am? Here are some elaborations of this question. Am I free or good or intelligent because God created me that way, or did God create me broken in some sense? Am I free or good or intelligent because of cosmic or human nature, or do I have no nature whatsoever? Or am I the way I am because of something I did in a past life, or because of some fate that has been bestowed on me before or at birth, or because of random mutation and natural selection? Such questions about the cell's innate freedom, goodness, and intelligence divide fairly neatly between Abrahamic East Asian and South Asian religious philosophy. Abrahamic religious philosophy, at least in its Christian and Muslim forms, has wrestled with the question of how to reconcile human freedom and divine sovereignty. East Asian religious philosophy, especially Confucianism, has contended about the innate goodness of humans. And in South Asian religious philosophy, one crucial issue concerns whether the self already is enlightened or must acquire it. With regard to Lakota traditional ways, there is not only an original relationality, but also an original sacred mystery known as Wakan. And in Yoruba thought, the problem of free will, if it is even that, does not attempt to square human responsibility with divine sovereignty, but rather a person's destiny or ori with their principle of strife and struggle or essay. Finally, my section on contemporary philosophy of religion takes up neuroscientific evidence relating to free will, Dawkins' selfish gene, Nietzsche's will to power, and Butler's performance of gender. Readers are therefore left with a sense of the multifaceted complexity of questions regarding the original freedom, goodness, and enlightenment of humans. I think really there's too much going on in this chapter, especially at the end. I found it most helpful in each section to focus on one debate and go deep. Then I feel guilty that I've left something out, since writing an undergraduate textbook really sucks. There's no way to win. My third question turns from the cell's origins to its destinations. Here, questions are simply whether the cell survives death, and if so, how. These questions would seem to be among the most pressing for many humans. Moreover, how humans answer these questions sometimes has profound consequences for how they live their lives. Still, in the context of the preceding two chapters, one might wonder whether this third question is predicated on false or limited understandings of what the self is. If we're not, in fact, an individual substantial autonomous self, then there isn't such a thing to survive death. Nevertheless, many different religious traditions do maintain the notion of individuated post-mortem heavenly existence. Interestingly, this view shows up in different cultures across the globe. But just as interesting is the fact that each of these traditions also contains views of postmortem existence as non-individuated. Still, other traditions think of postmortem existence as less heavenly and more familial in the sense of reuniting with ancestors of the dead. And in other cases, it just is impossible to say what happens after death, or it isn't important to say what happens after death, or we simply don't die. Some of the religious philosophical content to be considered in the context of this question includes the bevy of Vedic and non-Vedic positions in South Asian philosophy, the relative lack of concern with this question in early Confucian Taoist texts, which can be contrasted with the obsessions of some later Taoist and Mahayana Buddhist teachings, intriguing forms of reincarnation in Lakota and Yoruba traditional ways, a panoply of different positions in Abrahamic scripture, theology and mysticism, and both substance dualism and religious naturalism in contemporary philosophy religion. My fourth question about the self turns to the paths by which the self reaches its destination. As in the case of the previous questions, there's an abundance of material to cover, not only different paths for different religious traditions, but also different paths within religious traditions. But there's also, in this case, abundance of ways to focus this material. I'm really struggling with this chapter. One such way would be to look at whether these paths primarily involve the body or the mind or both. Another way would be to look at the difference between cat paths and monkey paths. Here are even more ways to focus this material. Does the path lead to a post-mortem, otherworldly destination, or to this life, this worldly destination? Does the path require multiple lifetimes or just one? Should the destination be the focus of the path, or does focusing on the destination distract from the path? Does the path need to be found or chosen, or are we already on it and just need to wake up to that reality? For now, though, I'm mostly intrigued by focusing this material through the relationship between morality and religion. Whereas many of my students assume that the whole point of religion is to teach and reinforce morality, some religious philosophers, as we all know, have argued that the focus on conventional morality and social conformity is to lose the spirit and substance of religion. To put the matter in terms of this question is to get distracted from the religious path. So the question here for me becomes this: does the path demand adherence to moral norms, social conventions, and ritual participation, or does it require going beyond such things? Were I to pursue this, I might focus on trickster figures in Yoruba and Lakota, deviant saints such as Krishna Kaitana and Ramakrishna in South Asian religious philosophy, Taoist amorality and Zen immorality, mystics such as Rabia Halaj, Marguerite Perret, and Meister Eckhart, and of course, Kierke. My final question about the cell looks at the obstacles that prevent it from reaching its destination. When I originally considered the topic of destinations under question 3, I focused the question of whether the cell survives death and if so how. I focused on the question of whether the cell survives death and if so how. Here I look instead at this worldly side of our ultimate destinations: salvation, enlightenment, harmony, attunement, obedience, submission, health, flourishing, and so forth. My question in this case is, what keeps us from reaching these destinations? Or to put the question a bit more precisely, what keeps us from living the way we should? In a sense, this is a question of ethics, in another sense, not. One way to think about this question is as the flip side of the fourth question above. There I looked at the relationship between religion and morality, asking how we should live, and focusing on the issue of whether this requires going beyond morality. Here I instead look at what prevents us from living the way we should, which in some cases is immoral behavior, but in other cases is just the opposite. Here is another way in which the content of this question goes beyond ethics. For many religious traditions, what prevents humans from living the way they should is not a function of the moral decisions they make, but rather an original condition that afflicts them simply by virtue of being human. Christians will know this as original sin. In other traditions, it is something else, an original imbalance, evil urge, selfishness, or ignorance, or illness. In still other traditions, this original condition is existence itself, which keeps us separated from Brahma, or Tao, or God, or ancestors. In yet other traditions, this condition involves our delusion that there is a problem in the first place. What keeps us from living the way we should is thinking that we are not living the way we should. Of course, there is also the problem of evil beings, demons, witches, anti-gods, and there is also the fact that for some philosophers of religion, it is human beings themselves that keep us from living the way we should by creating oppressive social realities. Patriarchy certainly fits here, so does slavery, perhaps also capitalism. Some would even say that what keeps us from living the way we should is religion itself. I turn now to the journey of the cosmos, repeating each of my 5 questions, but with respect to the cosmos rather than the self. 2 clarifications are first in order. By cosmos, I mean simply everything that exists taken as an ordered whole. And as for the cosmos' journey, I don't presume a teleological view of the cosmos. Just like the case of the journey of the self, null results and question rejections are important and interesting as positive answers. Maybe the cosmos has a beginning, path, and end, maybe not. Thus are 5 questions. I won't repeat them. As for the first or sixth question overall, what is the cosmos? We can begin by recognizing that just as in the case of the self, appearances can be misleading. We might think that the cosmos exists in a manner that's fully independent and real, just as we do with itself. But answers to this first question show how many philosophies of religion challenges common sense view. Perhaps the cosmos is only illusion. Perhaps it's just God. Perhaps it's really constituted by underlying cosmic principles and forces. Perhaps it is atomistic. Perhaps it is composed by numerous universes. Perhaps it involves realms of ancestors. Perhaps it is ultimately a heavenly existence, whether with or without some kind of deity. Whatever the case, what is particularly interesting is how these cosmologies serve spiritual practices and rituals. Perhaps this is also the case with some contemporary philosophers of religion that draw on Big Bang cosmology or alleged evidence of fine-tuning and design. Regardless, the ostensible predominance of scientific cosmologies for our own age raises an interesting question. How can religious traditions continue to offer cosmologies for religious practice? Question 2 about the cosmos takes up some of the central questions of contemporary theistic philosophy of religion. Does the cosmos have an origin, and if so, what is its nature? Ever since the Enlightenment, if not earlier, philosophy of religion in Europe and some of its colonies has been predominantly concerned with these questions, so much so that it is just natural for many of us to think that these are the central questions for philosophy of religion in general. But this is not the case. Many other religious traditions don't think of God as a creator. And some of those religious traditions that do think of God as a creator tend to think of God as remote and uninvolved. In these cases, the existence of God just isn't very important to actual religion. This can be a point of instruction for traditional philosophy of religion. The origin of the cosmos and nature of its originator isn't apparently all that important for most of the religious traditions of the world. Another point of instruction. These questions just aren't live for most religious traditions because they simply don't matter to practice. Question 3 turns from the origin of the cosmos to its end. Or question 8, I guess is what's on the slide. These questions here are, does the cosmos have an end? If so, what happens after that? In this case, it is necessary to ask these questions not only about the cosmos writ large, but also about this world or this order, where these terms refer to the way things currently are for humans in their habitable space as interpreted religiously. This is due to the fact that for many religious traditions, the end is not really the end. Rather, it's merely the beginning of something new or different, a new or different world here on Earth or in some other realm. What is interesting about many of these cases is that they occur during times of significant trouble. Maybe there's a prolonged drought or flood. Maybe there's an invasion and life under oppressive foreign rule. Maybe there's a natural disaster that significantly alters the practice and the structures of a society. Maybe there's a rapid change of customs and values that threaten age-old traditions. It is during such times that we tend to see heightened concern for apocalyptic or eschatological religious ideas and practices. Why? Such ideas and practices provide relief in at least two ways. They predict an imminent end to the trouble and a future state without troubles. They predict the reward for those who have suffered unfairly and a punishment for those who have caused this suffering. Content for this chapter includes the fascinating case of Boboka and the Ghost Bands, fervor for the Messiah or Mahdi, the Mapo Dharma, future manifestations of avatars and Buddhas, and the currently fashionable cosmological scenarios of Big Crunch, Big Freeze, and Big Rip. I think this is the best part of the research I've done so far. Learning about Big Crunch, Big Freeze, and Big Rip. The cosmologists, man, they do much better with the naming than philosophy. Need better branding. My ninth question concerns the path of the cosmos. Here I use the metaphor of path to generate philosophical questions about how the cosmos operates or functions in between its origin and its end, if in fact it has an origin or end. For many, questions about how the cosmos operates or functions are answered by science. The cosmos operates or functions according to so-called natural laws. But some religious traditions believe in and value the occurrence of things that would appear to violate natural laws, miracles, theophanies, hierophanies, and other religious experiences. Perhaps one issue here concerns what falls under the category laws of nature. Are there current laws or laws yet to be discovered that would encompass so-called miracles? If so, do these laws explain away miracles, or do they provide scientific mechanisms by which miracles can happen? And what about cultures for which the categories, laws of nature, miracles don't exist or aren't opposed? Cultures for which seemingly miraculous occurrences are understood to be part of the naturalist worldly order. One should be careful in these cases, indeed in all cases, to contextualize religious philosophies. Still, given the dominance of science in our contemporary world, I think it best to focus on that which would seem to elude scientific explanation or violate natural law. My final question examines the obstacles that lie in the way of the journey of the cosmos. If, per the last question, the path of the cosmos concerns its functioning and order, then the obstacles along its path will be the things that stand in the way of this functioning and order. The question in this latter case is this: what prevents the cosmos from working the way it should? Here I examine the classical problem of evil in the case of Abraham and contemporary philosophy of religion. With regard to South Asian philosophy of religion, I look at Nyaya and Vedanta efforts to defend the justice of God. With regard to East Asian philosophy of religion, the Korean and Neo-Confucian 4-7 debate about the relationship between Qi and Li. And with regard to Yoruba and Lakota philosophy of religion, the role of evil spirits and the evils of colonialism. These 10 questions constitute the 10 content chapters of my textbook, chapters 6 to 15. They're preceded by 5 chapters on the method or grammar of global critical philosophy religion. I'll end my talk today by looking briefly at these chapters, focusing particular material that is germane to issues of method and theory. Chapter 1 simply looks at what I call the traditions of philosophy religion. It is here that I introduce readers to the 6 traditions through which they will later philosophize about religion in chapters 6 to 15. Focusing particularly on the Vada tradition in South Asia, the period when 100 schools contended in East Asia, traditional religious philosophy and post-colonial philosophy religion in the case of Yoruba and Lakota, medieval religious philosophy in the case of the Abrahamic tradition, and contemporary theistic philosophy religion. In each case, I show how traditions of philosophizing about religion are products of their historical and cultural context. More particularly, I look at the context of philosophy, how the context of the philosophy of religion informs its ends, which in turn motivates its form and content. Thus, there is no given or essential content for philosophy of religion. Rather, the religious ideas and issues that people reason about and debate together vary from place to place and time to time. It is therefore unfair to make the content of one philosophy of religion normative for other philosophies of religion with different contexts and ends. I take it that I'm preaching to the choir there. The chapter finally ends by asking student readers to reflect on the context and ends of their own philosophy of religion, how the context and ends of their own philosophy of religion might influence its content. Chapter 2 asks, what is a religion? What is religion and what is a religion? The ultimate goal of the chapter is to encourage critical thinking about these categories. To get there, I begin with a lengthy introduction to the religious aspects of the six traditions, focusing on the ritual practice and cultural embeddedness. The chapter then formally takes up the question of whether religion ought to be abolished or reformed. It next moves into territory concerning the diversity over space and change over time of any particular religious tradition. And the chapter finally ends by examining issues concerning who gets to speak for and represent particular religious traditions. Chapter 3 turns to philosophy, looking first at Western philosophy, showing how, once again, context informs ends, informs method, informs content. Also at issue here is Western philosophy's failed attempts to wall itself off from the contaminations of religion and rhetoric. In the case of so-called non-Western philosophy, I focus on insights and methods that prove useful to global critical philosophy religion. In the case of South Asian philosophy of religion, the many-sidedness of reality and Jain philosophy, and the sensitivity to shared sources of knowledge in the Vedic tradition. I have a long section on what is a legitimate source of knowledge and what is an illegitimate appeal to authority. I think that thinking through the Vedic tradition makes that complex in a way that I just don't find it for Western philosophy. In the case of East Asian philosophy of religion, the concern, I focus on the concern for the relationship between names and reality, Taoism and Zhuangzi. In the case of Lakota philosophy, the emphasis on epistemic relationality or holism. And in the case of African philosophy, the question of whether philosophy is worldview or critical interrogation of worldview. That's another bright spot of the research I've done, is the wonderful African philosophy of religion, the whole debate about ethnocentrism and going beyond ethnocentrism. In the section to follow, I assemble some practical tools for philosophizing about religion. Conceptual analysis, which I find represented not just in Western analytic philosophy, but also in Chinese and Indian philosophy. Argumentative evaluation, in which I itemize some of the forms of argumentation in Western philosophy and supplement that with an examination of the complexity of the appeal of authority in the Vedic tradition. And personal intuition and interpretive insight is represented not only in the Western traditions of phenomenology and hermeneutics, but also in the Lakota and Naruto religious philosophy. The chapter then ends by considering the two different ends of philosophy and religion in general, by looking at the two different ends of philosophy and religion in African philosophy. First, the understanding of religious philosophies. Second, critical philosophical examination of those religious philosophies. Chapter 4 finally takes up the method of philosophy and religion. First, it defends the claim that global critical philosophy and religion takes as its content historical acts of reason-giving from a diversity of traditions and communities, not just the historical abstractions of theism. Then it elaborates a three-step method for global critical philosophy of religion: description, comparison, and evaluation. With regard to description, I advocate looking at four aspects of acts of religious reason-giving: the logical form of the act, the conceptual meanings of the act, the contextual setting of the act, and the political uses of the act. With regard to comparison, I caution against the uncritical assumption that some particular is itself a general category rather than just one instance of that category. Then I provide some tools for vetting comparative categories. And with regard to evaluation, I defend and clarify it in five ways. Religious traditions and communities make claims about what is real, true, and good. To understand and evaluate these claims is to take them seriously. Humans care about what is real, true, and good. To understand and evaluate these claims is to take ourselves seriously. Evaluation in global critical philosophy religion can be empathetic, humble, and fatalistic. It is not for the sake of proving others wrong or inferior. Philosophy always has and always will require chutzpah. Philosophy simply is, or at least involves, raising and pursuing questions of meaning, truth, and value. Global critical philosophy religion is no different in this respect. And finally, philosophy religion is, I believe, at the end of the day, a personal endeavor. To the extent that reasons are relevant to my own religious beliefs and practices, I use philosophy religion to help me understand which beliefs are true for me, which practices are conducive to the flourishing of my own life. The final chapter of the first section of the book then takes up and defends the usefulness of the journey metaphor for restructuring philosophy religion. This is the material that is contained in the opening section of this paper. Thus, we end where we began. That's the end. I just have one other slide that has the whole shebang. Thanks.